you frequently hear from the media that administration's willingness to prosecute people who leak information is having a chilling effect on the willingness of their sources to come forward. But you read in the newspaper, you read classified information that comes out in the newspaper every day. Does that mean there is no chilling effect, or simply that it's something that's very hard to measure and report upon? And I think it's a little bit of the same thing. We know that we are seeing adversaries who are noting the press stories and suggesting that they ought to change their communications. We don't know what communications we're not seeing anymore, and we don't know what the impact is going to be of failure to intercept those communications.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. That was the estimable Robert Litt, General Counsel to the Director of National Intelligence, and one of the federal government's point people on the Snowden mess. Litt came by the Brookings Institution on Monday to talk about implementation of the changes announced in President Obama's big speech on NSA reform. We talked about the current state of play in the politics and policy of signals intelligence in the wake of the speech. We talked about privacy and what it means for the U.S. government to recognize privacy rights in overseas espionage against non-U.S. citizens. We talked about the big questions the president's speech left open. We talked about the question of amnesty for Edward Snowden. We talked about the press, and yes, we talked about how you can tell, if you can tell, that the Snowden revelations have actually caused damage to U.S. national security. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 60, wherein we talk to DNI General Counsel Robert Litt.
We've had a presidential speech, we've had the review group report, we've had the PCLOB report, we've had numerous legislative proposals, we've had hearings. They're all sort of mashed together in this giant soup. Where are we following these set of disclosures?
Well, between the presidential policy directive and the speech, the president laid out a number of decisions that had been taken. Many of them are going to require work going forward, and we're working on those already on varying time frames. I mean, for example, he's directed that there be options presented to him by March 28th on how to modify the Section 215 program. He's required that there be, we look at the Section 702 program, just a whole list of issues there that are going to require action going forward. I do want to say that there's been sort of a lot of reporting out there about the president rejecting other recommendations of the review group. And I think it's important to note that just because the president didn't say anything about it in his speech or in the PPD doesn't mean that the recommendation has been rejected. There are a lot of recommendations in there that are still being worked upon and evaluated that just didn't get mentioned in the speech. And so that's another work stream that's going on.
So what are, from your point of view, the major issues that are being worked through now that we don't have a sort of final sense of the administration's direction on, but are still sort of meaningfully in play?
Short term, there's a question of what exactly are we going to do with the telephone metadata program. The president ordered some short term fixes that are in the process of being accomplished, but there's the broader question of, all right, how can we set up a program that is going to meaningfully prove operationally useful, but provide greater protections.
And just to stop you on the short-term fixes for a moment, one of the short-term changes is something that the president can simply order, which is, stopping at two hops rather than going to three. But one of them is something that requires the FISA court's cooperation. And, judging from the history of interaction between the executive branch and the FISA court over this program, it's not clear to me why the FISA court would think it has the authority to get involved other than as an equitable matter with respect to, errors and misconduct. It's not clear why it would have the authority to get involved in approving individual queries. I was a little bit surprised to see that in the president's speech. Is there a path forward on that that gets you to a position where every query is approved by the judge without congressional action?
Well, that was true for a period of time in 2009. There was a period of about 6 months where the FISA court did review every query under its own order. And so I think the assumption is that the FISA court would have the authority to modify its order. In other words, the order under the bulk telephony metadata program contains a number of conditions and restrictions that are put in to ensure that the program complies with the law and adequately protects privacy. And I think that the FISA court has a degree of discretion in what conditions it imposes as a result of that.
I see. So you have that big basket of stuff. What else?
The president in the PPD set out a number of restrictions on the manner in which we'll conduct signals intelligence in generally, and in particular, the uses we'll make of bulk collection of signals intelligence. And those need to be implemented, exactly how we're going to do that. There's a directive in there that that the intelligence community establish procedures to ensure protection of privacy rights of people, whether or not they're U.S. persons. We're going to have to implement that as well. And then in the speech, there was a directive to the Attorney General and the DNI, I believe, to develop additional restrictions on the use and dissemination of U.S. person information collected under Section 702.
Particularly with respect to use in criminal trials,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So this is all stuff that notionally gets resolved in the next few months, right?
And few months out to a year.
So one imagines a very intense interagency process that's been going on and now focuses on these very intensely. Talk a little bit about that. The different agencies here have very different equities, very different concerns. The president and the DNI have to harmonize it all somehow into a single position. What does that look like as a workflow matter?
Well, you know, the fact that different agencies have different positions is pretty typical of the interagency process. If everybody has the same position, there's no real need to have a process. But what you do is you start at a working level and then you work your way up through the national security hierarchy with an attempt to reach compromises. I think the ultimate goal of everybody here is to try to maintain both operational utility in a manner that enables us to protect the nation and our allies, and at the same time provides both greater protections for civil liberties and privacy and greater transparency and assurance to the public that we are providing those protections.
So to me, the most interesting and surprising thing in the president's speech is it's twofold. I want to treat them in turn. One is just the fact that he announces a PPD that is then released publicly. The second is that this contains a pervasive acknowledgement that the non-U.S. person overseas has privacy rights. It seems to me these are independently and particularly in conjunction with one another, very dramatic things that get a little bit overlooked in the course of discussing the specific contours of the policy proposals that he advances. So I want to talk, first of all, about just the fact of the PPD. What does it mean that the United States, I think for the first time, has a sort of public doctrine of what it does and doesn't do with signals intelligence? And to what extent does that change the posture of the United States vis-a-vis its foreign interlocutors and, with any luck, international public opinion as well?
Well, on the first point, I mean, obviously, Executive Order 12333 already provides some degree of guidance about what we do and do not do with respect to intelligence generally and respect to signals intelligence in particular. So it's not entirely novel. I think this is a degree of granularity that goes beyond what's been done before, but I think that's something that's justified by the circumstances we're in now. But it's not, I mean, the president owns the national intelligence process. And I don't think it's at all surprising that he would be saying, here's how I want intelligence to be conducted. I can't remember what the other half of your question was.
Well, I mean, so do any of our foreign interlocutors have anything comparable to the PPD? Is there any country that you know of that had where there's a, you know, a document that I can look up that you know, gives comparable guidance about what they do and don't do?
You know, I'm hesitant to answer that question definitively because I haven't really personally engaged in a lot of research about the laws governing intelligence of other countries. I do believe that I do believe that there are restrictions in other countries on some of the things their intelligence agencies can do. Many of them embodied in the law. I mean, the Germans, I happen to know, have a limitation on what they can do with bulk collection. But I do think that overall we probably have, between our statutes and the executive orders and the new PPD, we probably have the most robust set of restrictions and protections over our intelligence community of any country in the world.
And what has been the reception of the speech and the PPD in, you know, our very anxious foreign interlocutors so far?
I think by and large, to the extent I've seen it, it's been guardedly positive. I think they welcome what the president has said, and they're looking forward to seeing how it's actually going to be implemented. I know that Alex Joel, who was our Civil Liberties Protection Officer, was in Brussels this past week with a variety of meetings and participating in a panel. And I think that was the message that he got, that people welcomed this as a sign of progress, but are looking forward to how this is actually going to be carried out.
Which brings us to the question of what it means for the United States to acknowledge in intelligence work a privacy right of foreign nationals overseas. I can see sort of two broad answers to that. One is that once you acknowledge privacy rights as an intelligence community, that's a kind of game-changing acknowledgement, and it has very broad potential significance for, in practice, for what you can and can't collect and what you can and can't do with the things you collect. Alternatively, I could see the argument that actually it has very little practical implication because we don't really collect willy-nilly against foreigners anyway, and therefore we're simply calling now privacy what we used to call good judgment. And I'm wondering how, you know, as somebody who's going to have to implement all of this, what do you make of it when the president says we now acknowledge that there's privacy rights for foreigners overseas when we conduct intelligence?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think at one level, it is a recognition of the obvious. In the world we're in today, citizens of any country have a degree of privacy right that need to be protected. And I think that for the president to acknowledge that publicly is a recognition of a reality that existed prior to his public acknowledgement, but the fact that he made that acknowledgement, I think, is a significant step. In terms of the operational impact, I think the president's speech has already made clear with respect to the limitations on collections against certain foreign leaders that we are prepared to accept some constraints on our intelligence collection activities beyond what we've already done in the interests of some of the things that are set forth in the PPD, international relations and protecting the privacy of persons outside the U.S. And I think that over the course of the next few months, this is one of the things we're going to have to sort out, which is exactly how we draw that line and provide appropriate protections for people who are not citizens of the United States, while at the same time not imposing constraints on our ability to gather intelligence that is useful to protect not only Americans, but the citizens of those countries. I mean, we share a lot of information with intelligence services of other countries that we gain pursuant to our signals intelligence activity. And they know that, and they want us to be able to continue to do that.
So today, before the president's speech, if I asked you the question, to what extent does the United States consider the privacy of foreign nationals in conducting foreign intelligence, what would you have said, and how different do you think that answer will be after implementation of the president's speech?
Well, I'm not in a position to say how different it's going to be, because that's what we're going to going to work out. What I would have said and what I did say before is we don't and never have indiscriminately collected and reviewed communications of persons outside the United States. Whatever people may think, the United States intelligence community is not interested in what some German housewife is saying to her husband about the shopping list she wants him to bring home. We're limited by the need to generate useful foreign intelligence, which has both a sort of structural component, which is to say that's a rule we follow. We disseminate information that's of foreign intelligence value, and a practical component, which is there, you know, we want to focus our attention on what's important. So that's what I would have said and did say in meetings with Europeans, even before the president's speech.
You know, when I think about in the past that set of values, right, not being interested in the German housewife's shopping list, I would have described that as not really a privacy value, but effectuating a privacy value by focusing on what's in fact important from a foreign intelligence standpoint. Would you have described that as a respect for privacy or merely good intelligence work, or are they in fact the same thing?
Well, I think the important thing to focus on is what the effect of it is. I wasn't here when Executive Order 12333 was revised. I don't know what people's motives were. I do know that rule, among others, provides protection for privacy rights of non-U.S. persons. I think the president's speech made that recognition explicit.
I see. So, made it explicit, did more than make it explicit, right? Said that we're now going to consider privacy explicitly in the design and structure of SIGINT collection programs. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how different is that from considering effectiveness if one of the spin-off consequences of collecting effectively is that you protect privacy?
Well, as I said, first, I think that's what we're going to have to determine going forward. But the president has made clear that we're willing to, in service of overall national interests, we're willing to accept some limitations that we might not otherwise have on our collection of foreign intelligence. And that, I think it's that give and take that's going to play out over the next few months.
So let's talk about the specific limitation with respect to foreign leaders. I imagine if I were a foreign leader, I would, and I were not Angela Merkel, who presumably has a very good sense of this. The president's speech makes clear that he's only talking about close friends and allies and only talking about the heads of state or the most senior leadership of those countries. And so I would be spending some time right now scratching my head and wondering, am I on the no-spy list or am I not on the no-spy list? I'm curious what the intended reception of that is, and you know, is the idea to create a certain sense that there is a safe group, but nobody knows quite who's in it, or that it's fluid? How should we understand that sort of that description?
I don't know how to answer that specifically, other than to say that there's an interagency process that's determining who and what are the appropriate targets of signals intelligence collection. Obviously, one of the reasons we don't talk about who we are and are not specifically targeting is precisely to avoid this kind of discussion. But the president made clear that he wants a fairly rigorous process to evaluate who and what we're targeting, and that's going to be the case going forward.
And I assume that that process, from his speech, was clearly designed to weigh the costs of blowback against the potential benefits of collection. I mean, is that the sort of ultimate threshold here?
That's certainly an important part of the calculus. I do think that in general, going forward, the intelligence community needs to pay more attention to the issue of what happens if this is disclosed, in terms of determining a whole spectrum of activities going forward.
So one of the things that the president speech really surprised me about it, given how much criticism he has taken for not energetically defending the community in public, was how robust and passionate the entire sort of first third of the speech was. And I'm interested in sort of how that played internally. It really surprised me. It evidently surprised some other people. What was the response to it inside the community?
So my perception was that criticism of the president for inadequate defense was largely coming from outside, not from inside. I think that the president and the White House had been fairly consistent since the beginning of this in standing behind the NSA and the intelligence community in general. I think if you go back and look at statements made during a variety of press briefings and so on, it's fairly consistent. I think that people were pleased that the president took so much of the speech to defend the intelligence community and the process of gathering intelligence. But I don't think people inside necessarily viewed that as a change.
It's interesting. I mean, I have this sense from, again, from the outside, that there has been, you know, sort of a morale sag. And I was, personally surprised when the president comes out and talks about the Sons of Liberty and sort of situates the birth of NSA in that context, which is not, it really wasn't an on the one hand, on the other hand kind of discussion.
Well, I do think there's a morale issue, which is sort of twofold. Number one, it's no fun to wake up every morning and have read in the paper accusations that you're doing things that you aren't doing. And number two, I think that people at NSA really would much rather be spending their time collecting and analyzing signals intelligence to protect the nation than responding to this sort of stuff. There's been a tremendous diversion of resources at NSA and throughout the intelligence community to deal with this. And I think that people view this as a diversion from the mission and something that they'd rather not be doing.
So let's talk about the press coverage. This started out with a series of revelations that were of enormous policy significance and arguably relatively low operational significance. And it has evolved, at least in my view, to a series of stories that are of almost no policy significance and very significant operational potential. I'm curious for your thoughts on the press coverage of it. And, you know, it's been reported that you're, to some degree, the point person on responding to, you know, a lot of inquiries. What are your thoughts on the institutional performance of the press in this area?
I think it varies. I think there are some reporters who are very concerned both about getting their story right and about trying to avoid publishing things that are going to cause damage to national security, even if they may sometimes draw the line in a different place. But they're demonstrating a genuine concern. And we have had some very productive interactions with reporters where we have been able to point out to them that if you publish this, it will cause this kind of harm. I think there are other reporters who are less willing to come to us, less willing to listen to us, and more interested in pushing a story that will get more clicks on the website. That's a little more frustrating.
One of the things that I get asked about all the time is, you know, I say things like these stories have significant operational consequences, and inevitably somebody comes back to me and says, you know, what's the evidence of any harm here? The one thing we know we have is a debate. It's a debate we should have had a long time ago, and this has enabled a discussion that wouldn't have been possible without it. On the other hand, you know, principal after principal has testified and stated publicly that there are very severe consequences here that are not visible to the public. And I'm curious, A, what we can say about consequences and harms, and B, how do you get people to believe that there are, to the extent that there are harms you can't talk about, significant and if invisible ones?
So I have two responses on that. The first is, when what we're talking about is that when the nature of the harm is that our adversaries, be they nation states or terrorist groups or sanctions evaders or whatever, that they are going to look at information that comes out about how what we can and do intercept. And if the nature of the harm is they're going to be able to see that and they're going to be able to change their patterns of communications, I think it's pretty easy to understand why it's difficult for us to get specific about what we're seeing out there, because that, again, is going to reveal exactly what kind of communications we're intercepting. I can tell you that I have seen intelligence, that we are seeing this kind of reflection. Am I able to say that as a result of this, there will be a terrorist attack that we can't prevent? No. And that goes to the second nature, the second response I want to make, which is it's very, very difficult to ascribe that kind of direct line between a loss of intelligence and a particular action. If I can make an analogy, you frequently hear from the media that administration's willingness to prosecute people who leak information is having a chilling effect on the willingness of their sources to come forward. But you read in the newspaper, you read classified information that comes out in the newspaper every day. Does that mean there is no chilling effect, or simply that it's something that's very hard to measure and report upon? And I think it's a little bit of the same thing. We know that we are seeing adversaries who are noting the press stories and suggesting that they ought to change their communications. We don't know what communications we're not seeing anymore, and we don't know what the impact is going to be of failure to intercept those communications.
So one of the other areas where the sides seem to just be talking past each other to me is on utility of the programs, which is, I suppose, the flip side of the question of consequences of not having the programs. Where one side is constantly looking for but-for causation in stopped attacks, and the other side is basically saying, well, you have a large number of cases in which data from these programs, particularly 215, is useful in eventual good outcomes. And it seems to me that what we really have going on here is either a very high threshold on the part of the critics for what constitutes value, or a sort of misunderstanding about what all source intelligence really is and the way the role of individual feeds of intelligence and data streams in eventual outcomes. I'm wondering if the community has really sort of been effective in talking about how data from programs like 215 actually get used in practice, and sort of what the difference is between a program's being useful and being valuable on the one hand and being sort of game-changing in particular cases looks like.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it reflects a broader lack of understanding of the difference between intelligence and criminal investigation. I think that people are comparing the process of intelligence collection and analysis to what happens in a criminal investigation, and they're fundamentally very different. In a criminal investigation, something has happened and you're trying to find out who did it and perhaps specifically what happened. And it's sort of very retrospective and focused. Intelligence investigation, you're trying to find out what's happening out there. And so it involves a very different process of both of collecting information and the analytical approach you bring to it. I think it's and really the only real debate about utility has really focused on the bulk telephony metadata collection. I don't think there's been substantial question about the utility of most of the other collection.
I disagree. I mean, I think, the New America Foundation report the other day criticized 702 as well, criticized the evidence that 702 was significantly valuable in counterterrorism.
Well, that's just wrong. Sorry, that's just wrong. 702 is one of the most valuable sources of intelligence that we have, across the whole spectrum of foreign intelligence. But to go back to your other point, I think it's absolutely right that it is the wrong metric to try to take something like 215, which is several hops removed from an actual prevention of an event or apprehension of somebody, and measure it by the number of terrorist plots reported. And the analogy I'd give there is I have a fire insurance policy on my house. I don't determine whether I want to keep that fire insurance policy by the number of times it's paid off because my house burned down. I have it there in the event my house burns down in the future. We know from the report of the 9/11 Commission that there was a gap in our ability to identify terrorist communications before 9/11. I'm not prepared to say, and I don't think anybody could say, that had we had this program in effect, we could have stopped 9/11. But I do think it's the case that it is a gap in our collection capabilities and in our ability to identify individuals within the United States who may be in communication with terrorists outside the United States, and it's a gap that this program fills. And I would not want to have another incident where we said, oh, gee, if only we'd had this program, we could have prevented it. And I think that you have to measure that sort of insurance policy aspect against what I truly believe is a very minimal invasion of privacy rights accomplished by the program.
So I agree with you about the minimal invasion of privacy rights. But one of the problems, and therefore I have a high degree of comfort with 215, sort of irrespective of its measurable value. But one of the problems that mode of assessing value incurs, I think inevitably, is a certain inability to answer the question, well, what's it really good for? And so when the PCLOB says, hey, we don't see any evidence of value, or when the review group says, it's sort of valuable but not essential, there's no metric that you can come back with that says, okay, here's the standard against which you should judge it, and here is why it is or isn't meeting the standard. And that seems to me to make it very sort of difficult in any political environment to defend.
I agree. It's difficult to get metrics for something that's, as I said, is this many steps removed from the actual outcome. I mean, after all, what this is meant to do is either generate or rule out leads that are then followed up by other investigation. And it's hard to sort of say, okay, if we didn't have this, we wouldn't have accomplished that. It's just one of a number of different sources of information that feed into an overall intelligence operation.
So focusing on your insurance analogy, it seems to me when I talk to people who've been involved to one degree or another in the 215 program, a big part of their sense of its value has to do with the sense of reassurance that there's stuff that we would be picking up if something awful were happening that we're not picking up, or that, you know, a bomb goes off in Boston and you have a higher degree of confidence that it's a domestic thing because there's no 215 traffic involving the Tsarnaev phones. And people who look at it from the outside are looking for evidence of something happening rather than evidence of something not happening. Is that the core of the disparity?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I mean, I think that's an important aspect of it, is the ability to, I mean, after all, we do have limited resources. And even in an investigation like the Boston bombing, you need to say, okay, where are we going to direct our resources? So to the extent you have something that can enable you to focus your resources, that's useful. But I also think that entirely independent from that, this program exists in part to guard, to provide another possible alert for the thing that is happening, and not only to help us understand what isn't happening.
How significant is the difference between two hops and three operationally?
I think NSA has concluded that in the vast majority of cases, the third hop is not significant.
So let's talk about Snowden. There have been a lot of calls from New York Times editorial page, from any number of commentators for amnesty for him to allow him to return home. There is a certain amount of lionization of him. There's also a huge amount of anger from other sources. What do you make of the state of play involving Snowden, and how should we understand the government's posture toward him at this point?
Well, I guess I don't want to specifically talk about the state of play with Snowden. I will say that I think there's been a lot of confusion in the reporting of the various statements here, in particular sort of confusion of the concepts of amnesty and clemency and plea bargaining. Amnesty is a suggestion that all everything that has been done is forgiven without consequences. I think that that has pretty much been ruled out by public statements by the government. Clemency would be a situation where normally after a conviction, the president determines that a person is worthy of some amelioration in his sentence or even a pardon. But that's after a conviction. What has been talked about by the Attorney General is the possibility of some sort of plea bargain, which is a very, very routine process in criminal cases, which involves discussions between lawyers for the government and lawyers for the defendant, and reaching some sort of agreement that imposes some limitations on the number of counts to which someone pleads guilty, the sentence to which he's exposed, or so on and so forth. And I think that the what you've seen in the public statements from the government is that they're open to those kinds of discussions, which would provide some sort of limitation on Mr. Snowden. I mean, there have been, for example, people who have made the rather preposterous suggestion that he might face the death penalty if he came back here. I think I'm probably not going out on a limb to suggest that the government probably would be willing to bargain away the right to seek the death penalty, and probably more than that. But those are discussions that have to take place between his lawyers and the Department of Justice, not in the press.
But there have been there was an additional statement, which was Rick Ledgett's statement to 60 Minutes, that I think he was speaking in his personal capacity, that he was concerned enough about the removed but not yet disclosed volume of documents. I think he used he didn't challenge the number 1.7 million, that he would be willing, subject to clearance of a very high bar by Snowden, to contemplate, I think he may have used the word amnesty, as a way of recovering, if possible, that material. That was quickly disavowed. I take it the potential to recover material, it remains of high salience to the government?
So first, I think if you go back and look at the transcript of the 60 Minutes interview, you'll see that the reporter asked him about amnesty, and Rick did not talk about amnesty. Rick talked about something more akin to some sort of arrangement to be worked out. I think what was disavowed was the concept of amnesty, because it was reported that he had talked about amnesty, but I don't think that's what the transcript reflects. And in terms of the issue of restoring the documents, it's very common in plea bargaining arrangements, for example, for a defendant to offer restitution and for the government to take that into account in negotiating a plea. And so I think that that's the kind of consideration that would standardly be taken into account in determining what the appropriate disposition of a case is.
Because it would affect the magnitude of the perceived damage.
Correct.
And is your
and also sometimes, you know, there's a question of is this part of acceptance of responsibility on the part of the defendant, which is another consideration that comes into play.
And is your working assumption that everything that has been removed, i.e. if there is 1.7 million documents removed, that all of those are hopeless in terms of recovery? Or is your working assumption that that's an open question?
I guess I don't want to comment on that.
Thank you very much for joining
You're welcome.
Us.
Okay, always a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. This week, I'm asking your help to get the word out about the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet it, share this episode on Facebook, rate the podcast on whatever podcast distribution service you use. There are a lot of people out there in the world, and a remarkable number of them don't know about the Lawfare Podcast. You can help change that. Thanks for listening.